Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined by Eleanor Mills, editorial director at the Sunday Times and chair of Women in Journalism. Starting out as a reporter at Tank World, she went on to write for The Guardian, The Observer and The Telegraph, where aged 26 she became the paper's youngest features editor. An advocate for women in journalism, she's also led a high-profile campaign to protect children from online porn and recently conducted a headline-grabbing interview with Prime Minister Theresa May. Eleanor, thank you for joining me.
Nice to be here.
So, Eleanor, the first question I wanted to ask was, after Oxford, your first journalist break was at Tank World magazine. Now, I thought it was quite a militaristic operation, but in my research, it's described itself as the world's premier bulk liquid transportation publication. So it was the other kind of tank, was it not?
It was the other kind of tanks. It was road tanks, rail tanks, tank containers, every possible kind of tank. The best thing about working there was being able to drive the enormous cranes called spreaders that you lift them up with. That was really my high point.
So how on earth did you end up there? Let's talk about how you started in journalism. Because for me, when I saw Tank World and I realised what it was, it reminds me of those kind of things that you see at the end of Have I Got News For You, you know, when they have those obscure publications. Was that the first rung on the ladder, your first journalistic job?
Yeah, it really was. I had done some work experience on The Guardian through a family friend prior to that. But I found the job at Tank World through the Oxford University Careers Service.
Wow.
They were a tiny publisher called Baltic Publishing, and they had really grotty offices right on the M4, so you could see the tank containers whizzing past. And the editor of Tank World magazine was Andy Burnham.
Never heard of him.
Yeah. Now rather more famous as a Labour politician, wanting to be mayor of your hometown, I think.
Oh no, that's sacrilege. I'm a Yorkshireman.
Oh, you're a Yorkshireman. Up north, you see, I'm
the wrong side of the Pennines. That's regionalism as far as I'm concerned.
We're talking about isms. But yeah, Andy Burnham. So he was the editor. I was his editorial assistant. And of course, he went on into politics and I carried on in journalism. So the calibre of the people there was pretty good. We had a laugh, but I did it for about a year. That was enough. That was enough tanks.
Did you always want to be a journalist?
Yes. I think to be a journalist, you need to be rather nosy, rather confident, kind of person who'll go up and ask anyone any questions. And I always loved writing. So for me, it was a bit of a no-brainer.
So when you started at Oxford, was that a means to an end that you were going to get the degree so that you could become a journalist?
I studied English literature. I have to say, while I was at Oxford, I spent most of my time having rather a good time. But I did write some film reviews for the Charwell newspaper because I had a boyfriend in London, and it meant I could get my coach up to London paid for and a free movie ticket and go and see my bloke all for one. So that seemed like a good arrangement.
What kind of journalist did you want to be? Had you kind of seen all the president's men and kind of wanted to do the kind of Woodward Bernstein thing? How did you envisage your career panning out at that early stage?
Oh, that all sounds very grand. I don't think I really envisaged it panning out. It just seemed like more fun than kind of working for a living.
And you don't view it as working for a living?
I think it's about as much fun as you can have and get paid.
Well, absolutely. Well, we'll go into that in a second in terms of why you like journalism. But what came next? What came after Tank World?
I went back to The Observer. Because at that point, The Guardian had bought The Observer, and I worked for Rebecca Nicholson, who was then the new editor of the glossy magazine on The Observer, and I was her fixer. I used to do everything from make the tea to fix up the interviews, and I was a kind of not really working for any money at all. And then she finally gave me a proper job as the kind of editor of the back section of the magazine, I think on the princely sum of about £12,000. But it felt like a fortune then, and that was my proper kind of first salary. I did a little thing called How Much Do Other People Earn? And I used to have to find out every week kind of what people got paid for their jobs. That was quite good fun. And I ran lots of little different bits in the back. And I just kept on hassling, saying, please, can I write this? Please, can I write this? I've got an idea to do this. And I worked my way up within The Observer.
And at this point, had you started to get an inkling of what type of journalist you wanted to be and what you kind of wanted to write about, what direction you wanted to go in? Or were you still kind of caught up in the excitement of the job generally?
I was pretty caught up in the excitement of the job. There were a lot of kind of great parties because I was fixing lots of celebrity interviews. I used to get invited to all the launches for everything. It was really good fun, basically. And I wanted to write. I always wanted to write about people. I had lots of ideas for features. I was interested in what made the world tick, what people were interested in. I've always had a bit of a knack, I think, for knowing maybe what people want to read about. And I could do that from when I was very young. And I used to fix big celebrity interviews for Andrew Billen. So I think I'm now editor of the Sunday Times magazine, and I still spend time fixing big celebrity interviews. As I was coming in here this evening, I was trying to do that too. So there are some things that you learn from starting off in journalism that never stop. I've always been a features girl. I mean, I've done a lot of interviews and things myself, but I like people and what makes them tick and how the world works and what we're interested in and where it's going next. And what I love about journalism is every day is exploring all of that.
You recently interviewed Prime Minister Theresa May, and I was annoyed as a bloke that it just seemed to get sidetracked by the fact she was wearing leather trousers rather than what she was saying. How do you fix an interview with the Prime Minister like that? Because it really was attention-grabbing.
Well, I think there were two parts to that question. The first bit is Trousergate, which I have to say, when she walked down the steps, we were inside her personal apartment in Number 10, in the leather trousers, I did think inside, hooray, because I knew that they were going to make story. And it was a great shot, and it was kind of getting her off duty, and that we very much billed it as Theresa at home.
It was a great interview, actually.
Thank you. It was the first magazine interview. It was the first big profile interview she'd ever done. I mean, I was going through the cuts. They were pretty thin. There were a few things she'd done for her local paper.
Because you do care, actually, about what the Prime Minister's like as a person, and you don't get a sense of that when she's Home Secretary and being tough on criminals and all of that. You actually do want a kind of soft focus, not that it was, but a kind of a little more about them as a person and their temperament. And I think that, for me, that was why I read it.
Yes, and I think that was true of lots of people. I've got lots of relatives down in the countryside and who don't really follow the news that closely. And they'd all read that Theresa May interview, I think, for exactly that reason. They wanted to know what she was like, you know, what she liked, what makes her tick, what are her values, where does she come from? And people knew so little about her when she got the job. In fact, the interview was set up originally, it was going to be during her campaign, because she thought she was going to do 3 months of trying to campaign to get the Tory leadership. So it was going to be learn a bit more about Theresa May during the campaign. And then, of course, it all happened so quickly, it ended up being her first big interview as Prime Minister.
So how do you fix an interview like that? Because, I mean, I want to interview the Prime Minister, but I have no chance.
Well, it was a long process. Nothing with Theresa May ever happens particularly quickly. She likes process, she likes time, she likes to get it right. So I had been wooing quite a few of her aides for quite a long time. And then on top of that, Theresa May is diabetic. She's a type 1 diabetic. And I am, one of the things I do is I'm on the board of a diabetes charity called the Juvenile Diabetes Research Fund. And as part of that, I'd go to we do a lot of kind of fundraising dinners and things. And because she's diabetic, we had met at some of those things. She's also come to some of my Women in Journalism events, and I know her through a kind of women's network that we run at News UK. But I really got to know her on those long evenings raising money for diabetes, and I would sit next to her and often with her husband, Philip. So I did get to know her a bit, and we have a kind of rapport, and I think she thought she could trust me. And also I'm the editor of the magazine and I know a bit about politics, and I'd interviewed David Cameron, so I like to think maybe that was a good choice.
I mean, even though it's a great interview and she trusts you, you've obviously got to have that journalistic standard that you hold her to account in there. So is there ever a kind of unspoken to-ing and fro-ing as to what kind of tone you're going to take? Because she doesn't want to be hung out to dry, neither do you want to do that to her. But on the other hand, you've also got, if she says something that's newsworthy or that's going to be controversial, you can't be shy in reporting it.
Yeah, absolutely. When you go in to interview someone, even if you know them, you do it without fear or favour. You're there as a representative of the reader to ask the questions that they want answered, and it's a very special opportunity. The Prime Minister has incredibly tight diary, so get an hour with her one-to-one, and then we got another kind of hour and a half for the photographs, and I was also there then. To get that much of her diary is a real kind of treat. It's amazing access, so you really have to ask the questions, and I did. I asked her about the big investigation into child sexual abuse and whether she regretted setting that up, because it's been dogged by so much kind of controversy among the leaders of it.
We're on about our 67th chair now, aren't we?
Yeah, we're on the 67th chair. And she was absolutely resolute that she didn't regret doing that at all. I asked her all about her childhood and about her marriage, which she'd never opened up about. And we hadn't agreed those areas. I kind of went in and I tried. It's a bit like going fishing. You have a whole kind of, you put some bait on the line and you ask the questions. And I wasn't really sure what she would agree to answer and what she wouldn't, but I just kept plugging away.
How does it work in terms of your preparation and how much of yourself you put into the interview? Because there's, you know, everyone's got even an unconscious bias. How does that work?
Well, I'm interested. I've written a lot about women in power. I think we need more women in public life. I'm the chair of women in journalism, and I bang the drum a lot for more female voices within the media. I think we're often a very kind of male dominated society. So she knows that I'm going to be kind of pro the fact that she's a female leader. And I'm also very interested in questions around female leadership. Do women leaders make different kinds of choices? When that comes to news stories or, you know, within newspapers, I think that's really important. But particularly because newspapers are the first draft of history. And if you're only seeing history through a male lens, I think that's a real problem. In fact, it's one thing I've talked to Theresa May about this, and I talk about it a lot with my women in journalism hat on, that if we are, as a society, only see what we do through the eyes of men, then you're really misrepresenting and distorting what half the population thinks about things. And I do think that there's a very different take. And I think that it's very difficult for young women to always see themselves through the eyes of old lecherous men. I mean, that sounds a bit harsh, but if you have stale, pale male bias, which always wants a kind of pretty girl on the front of the paper because it thinks it sells, then what kind of messages are we giving our daughters about what we value them for? And that really does come from the media. And that's why I think it's very important to have more women, more mothers, a different kind of perspective at the helm. That goes for all diversity, but I think we can start with half the population.
And do you think that manifests itself in misogynist reporting? I mean, if you look at the Mail Online, for example, Paul Dacre, Martin Clark, these are all white men, and yet they objectify women in a lot of their kind of sidebar of shame. That you can tell that the newspapers are edited by old blokes.
I think it's not as simple as that. I think a lot of the Daily Mail has more female readers than any other publication. So let's not forget what we call internalised misogyny. There's a lot of older women who genuinely hold those rather negative views about other women. And the Daily Mail kind of picks up on that. I don't think it's as easy as just saying it's male editors picking those things. They often pick those things because they know that there's a particular female audience that quite likes reading them.
That likes to see other women put down in some way.
Yes, I think very much so. I think your Daily Mail reader, kind of in my own kind of personal life, some women who are like that. They do like disapproving and tutting about other women. Oh, is she wearing those trousers? Or, oh, it's disgraceful that young women could behave like that. There is a strain of that in our culture very strongly. And the Daily Mail doesn't create that. It stokes it and it reflects it.
And do you think that reflects the wider problem in society that women are objectified in that way? Because, like, you know, I've got loads of male colleagues, but I couldn't tell you what they were wearing today. Unless they've grown a particularly long beard over Christmas, I wouldn't even notice what they wear.
I think it's very striking that women are still often judged for the way that they look, not for kind of what they say or what they stand for. I think I do quite a lot of media myself. I think it's very interesting when you go on the television, everybody comments on what you were wearing. Oh, you look nice, your hair looked nice. They'd never really remember what you said. If you go on the radio, people say, oh, what you had to say was really interesting. And that counts for me, but that particularly counts for Theresa May. I mean, we didn't really hear very much about David Cameron's suits, although I'm sure they were a lot more expensive than her trousers. And there is a double standard around how women are judged in public life. And I think the Daily Mail is egregious on this score. I mean, I'll never forget the Daily Mail catwalk they did when they had Cameron appointed a whole load of new female ministers. The Daily Mail did the kind of Downing Street catwalk. What were they wearing?
It's disgraceful. I can remember Blair's Babes. Do you remember that?
Blair's Babes. Any woman who's in public life gets it. And I think it's very important that as a society, we look at that. And I think if you have more women choosing those pictures, that kind of thing, you get a lot of that. Although I'm trying to make a more complicated point to say that it's not just because men are choosing it, because there's a certain kind of misogyny which is in the culture. There are a lot of women who've internalised that and therefore see other women as threats or as competition or disapprove of them.
So, I mean, tell us about the genesis of women in journalism then, because as you started your career, did you start to realise that you needed to do something about this? Where did the genesis for it, where did it come from?
I didn't set it up. It was set up by Eve Pollard and a woman called Georgina Henry, who till a couple of years ago was the deputy editor of The Guardian. George and Eve realised, so that's going back, that we had our 21st birthday Widge last year. So it's been around for a long time. And I think what we all find slightly depressing is that things haven't really shifted that much in the last two decades. We still haven't had a female editor of a broadsheet. There have been some of the tabloids, or not since Rosie Boycott did The Independent. At the moment,
we've got Kath Viner at The Guardian.
But that's been a long time coming. There was a long period where there were no women in charge at the broadsheets. I think we're in an industry which is shrinking, And there's a phrase which they use in American kind of business speak about circling the wagons in industries which are declining, which often means more jobs for the boys. There were more women, I think, editing back at the end of the 90s, Rosie Boycott, Eve Pollard. And you got a lot of powerful women then in charge of features departments when there was lots of advertising. So you had this big influx of lifestyle journalism. And then you got quite a lot of female kind of barons running those kind of things. But I think that now you see less women, and less women, particularly in newsrooms, very few women covering business, not enough women in the lobby. So I think at the kind of sharp end, at the real kind of deep end of journalism, we don't have enough women. It's interesting that on TV that has changed. There's been such a fuss about not enough female voices that you now do get. We've got a female political editor, haven't we, now on the BBC? And I think that that has changed. It's now not acceptable, say, to have a Question Time panel which is entirely male, which up until very recently it was, because there's been a big fuss about, and you can actually see it on screen. But I think what's dangerous about newspapers is you can't necessarily see who's putting them together. And often the backbench is very male, and then you get a very stale, pale male lens on the news and on women and on attitudes. And I don't think that's great.
I mean, I've been listening to Five Lives Wake Up to Money for like 20 years, and it's always been an all-male lineup. And I think it was about October last year, Coletta Smith and Louise Cooper co-presented it. And I actually tweeted them and said, is this the first time we've had an all-female presenting lineup for this show in 20 years?
Yeah,
and
probably.
Both of them came back and said yes.
Yeah.
And the show's better for it, frankly.
Yeah, sometimes I go on the BBC and I do the BBC paper review, and that sometimes you get three women. You'll get kind of two female reviewers, sometimes me and Yasmin Alibi Brown and then Maxine Mowinney. And we always like that. That's like, because it used to be you would never get that. You might get a token woman, but not an all-woman panel. And there's some interesting research around what they call the power of three, that in any kind of group, if you have one woman there, then she speaks for all womankind. If you have two, then everyone's very interested to see how the women disagree. Once you have three, you're just seen as individuals.
People who just happen to
be women. Yeah, people who happen to be women and who have a point of view. So I think that's always important to remember.
Given my ignorance of women in journalism then, at the organisation, I should say, who is the target market? Who are you trying to lobby? What's its raison d'etre?
Well, we're there to encourage and support younger female journalists and all women in the profession. So we run lots of different kinds of events. We run a big mentoring scheme where lots of more senior women mentor younger ones. That's been very successful. We have about 60 mentees and 60 older journalists mentoring, and lots of our people are really kind of rising up the ranks. So that's really good. We run big events, how to get on in financial journalism, how to deal with being a mom and a journalist, what you do around commercial content, where are the barriers on things like sponsored editorial against, you know, and how does that affect your writing? They're always really popular because there's some money in that. How do you get on? How do you deal with a very kind of male-dominated newsroom? Lots of those kind of events. We have a kind of varied calendar, and we have about 1,000 members. It's a really thriving thing. I'm always delighted when I look out and when you speak to them, and there are all these keen young faces, and also lots of older ones, lots of people who maybe did used to work for newspapers and have gone off to have families or who've retired, and they come back. It's a real sisterhood.
And is it working? I mean, do you see newsrooms becoming less kind of pale, male and stale?
Is it working? Well, Eve and I were talking about this the other day, and Eve thinks that things are slightly going backwards. I think that there are more women around, and it's very important to have female voices. Certainly on the Sunday Times, where I work, I'm the editorial director and I'm the editor of the magazine. Sarah Baxter is the deputy editor on the Times. Emma Tucker is the deputy editor. Nicola Jill, who runs all the features and the magazine, very powerful there. So there are, you know, there are lots of powerful ladies around in Fleet Street. I wouldn't deny that, but still not enough. And what I'm very concerned about is where they are. We've been doing a study of where the women are, and what you see is kind of female ghettos. So of course, you know, around the style section or culture a bit, or those kind of softer sections, you tend to get more women, and not enough women in the newsroom, in the lobby,
or in the editor's chair,
on the business, yeah, or in the editor's chair.
Are you going to be the next editor of the Sunday Times?
Well, I would love to be. I don't think there's a vacancy there at the moment.
Oh, that's very good. That's what the kind of politicians say. I quite like that. How does it work, though? you know, as a journalist, that you interview the Prime Minister, you see her wearing a pair of leather trousers, and part of you must think, well, that is going to increase the noteworthiness of the interview because it reflects the fact she's relaxed and also it's unusual. But then part of it, do you also think, actually, I don't want the attention to get, you know, sidetracked by the fact she was wearing a pair of leather trousers and then they're not going to read the interview? Because you mentioned before we came on air that, you know, the Today programme was still asking you about her trousers 2 weeks later and not about the content of the interview. Does that frustrate you and please you in equal measure?
Well, as an editor of a magazine and the person who did the interview, I was delighted that it was still being talked about, and Trousergate is going to be a thing.
Trousergate is
definitely going to define it. It'll probably be in my obituary that I did the interview with Theresa May where she wore the trousers. So as a journalist, anything that makes your stuff stand out is great. But I do think it's a bit depressing that people fixated on the trousers rather than what she said about, say, Brexit or about her childhood or about sexual abuse, where she was really, I think, really good and trenchant and went further than she has done before in terms of how she sympathises with victims. But as I say, I think there is a double standard. I think also Theresa May is quite calculating. She uses her clothes to send signals. We know this. She's a bit like the Queen in that she uses them to stand out in a great kind of hall of dull men. And I don't think there's anything wrong with being a serious woman who's interested in fashion. In fact, fashion in the UK is one of our biggest industries. So I'm not in any way criticising her for that. I found it slightly depressing that 2 weeks later, the Today programme was still ringing me up asking me to talk about Trousergate. I thought it was maybe a little unnecessary.
Do you think she suffers discrimination being a woman even at the highest level with, like, other global leaders looking at her as a kind of female leader? Or do you think they just think of her as the Prime Minister who just happens to be a woman? How does that work?
Well, what do you... Donald Trump? I don't think...
Well, he seems to be the worst example of everything.
But he's not alone. If you think of Berlusconi, who made kind of derogatory remarks about Merkel, you know, being... And we won't go there, but he wouldn't be the first one. I think that leaders' club's probably always been a bit of a boys' club. Probably a bit less. It's a bit more kind of girl power these days. Angela Merkel and Theresa May and Christine Lagarde at the IMF. There's some serious ladies around, which I think is a good thing. And I hope that Trump is already calling her my Maggie. We need her to get on with Donald Trump, don't we, if we're going to get a good trade deal post-Brexit. She's got a very important role to play.
It worries me if I was her media advisor, which clearly I'm not, but she's about to appear on a press conference panel with Trump, you know, in the next few days. If he starts to be horrible on stage, how is she going to react? To me, that would be terrible, because she either if she doesn't criticise him there and then, she's going to run the risk of being criticised for legitimising it or enabling it or not standing up for whatever he's against of whatever he said. But on the other hand, if she challenges him, the President of the United States on stage right in front of him, he's going to react really badly. I mean, she, in a sense, she can't win.
She'll have to call him out if he says something really derogatory, but I'm sure that he won't. I mean, he's not an idiot, is he? I mean, we know he's definitely unpredictable, unconventional, I think pretty misogynistic in the things he said
mean.
About women.
I don't think he's a nice person. I think he's mean.
You think he's mean?
Yeah.
I haven't met him, so I wouldn't like to comment. I think he's very driven. There's an absolutely brilliant documentary on Channel 4 made by Matt Fry about Donald Trump's family, about his grandfather and about his father's grandfather who came over from Germany and actually made his money, his first fortune, by cooking the dead horses who died in the snow. It was the gold rush town. They were all digging for gold in the mountains in the far west, and all the mules were dying. And Trump's grandfather chopped up the meat from the dead mules, made them into burgers and sold them to the workers. And that was how he made his first fortune. Then he ran a whorehouse. But he comes from a whole series of chaps who thought they were kind of ubermensches. They thought they were better than everyone else, that they were a different breed. He has this thing about breeding, by which he means that he thinks that he is part of a race apart. He has a serious superiority complex. So I think for Theresa May, that's going to be an interesting diplomatic battle. But I will say something for Theresa. She's very good at handling men with large egos. She wasn't Home Secretary for all those years without being able to do that. And she's jolly tough. If you think about her at the Police Federation, where she told them all to their faces that they had to change and they were, you know, corrupt and racist and all that kind of stuff. She's not afraid to tell people hard truths, but I'm sure she'll be very conscious that she has to balance the needs of Brexit and Britain for a trade agreement with her own feelings about this particular chap.
I mean, because normally being Home Secretary is the kind of political graveyard career, isn't it? It's the cul-de-sac, because you can't win as Home Secretary. As long as you keep everyone locked up, no one really cares. But the minute they escape, it's your fault. It's a no-win. And it's very rare for a Home Secretary to proceed on to the top job, isn't
it? Well, she did. I think she was the longest-serving Home Secretary since 1874.
Wow.
And she managed it absolutely brilliantly. She's very careful. I have a slight worry that as Prime Minister, she might be too careful, and that actually what you need now is someone with a bit of vision and a bit of flair and someone who'll take some risks, a bit of a Churchill, because we're in a sticky moment. What you don't want is somebody cautious or too micromanaging.
Let's go back to your career, if we can. We left off when you were at The Observer. What came next?
Gosh, it's a long time ago. Observer, from The Observer, I worked on the magazine, and I then went and worked on the news desk. I went and became a kind of trainee on the news desk, and I did a couple of years working there and kind of covering stories and being a reporter, which was fun. I also still wrote quite a lot of features. And then I was headhunted by The Telegraph. I was offered a job as deputy features editor on the Daily Telegraph. I was about 25, 26, and I went to work for a woman called Karina Honan, who was a brilliant features journalist, very hard taskmaster. You'd go in and she'd kind of look at you, give you the dagger's look if you hadn't seen page 28 of The Mirror that morning. You know, she expected you to get in there at 8 o'clock having read everything, and I mean everything. But it was a really good hard schooling. She was very, very fastidious copy editor. She taught me a lot, so I did that for a bit, and then she was moved into another job and I became features editor. And I worked for Sarah Sands and Charles Moore on The Telegraph. And then the Sunday Times came knocking and said, would I like to go there and work? Sarah Baxter, actually, who's still my great mentor, who we worked together at The Observer. And she said, would I go and help her? She was editing News Review. And I went back and I helped her there. And I wrote the paper's big interview every week in the News Review. And then she went off on maternity leave. And I edited the News Review when I was about 28. Then I was focus editor on the Sunday Times, and then went back to News Review for a long stretch, had a couple of babies while I was doing that. Then I was Saturday editor of the Times, and then came back to the Sunday Times as a columnist.
So you've been back to the Sunday Times
director.
A few times, haven't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, they keep going back. It's a great newspaper.
And you were there, in effect, their main interviewer for quite some time, weren't you? You did kind of Mikhail Gorbachev and Charlton Heston.
Oh, yeah, all sorts of people. Hoskins.
That must have been incredibly exciting. Any kind of memorable takes? Who was the most fascinating person you've interviewed?
Well, I tell you what I really learned is don't interview your heroes. So I'd always loved Bob Hoskins. When I met him, he was absolutely horrible. He was like he was in The Long Good Friday. He was really scary. And I didn't get on too well with Billy Connolly either. Because I asked him, he kept going, he was doing a show which is all about how he was a welder, and I reminded him that actually he wasn't really a welder anymore. He'd been friends with Prince Andrew for years.
Yeah.
Weren't those jokes getting a bit stale? He got really furious with me, so much so that I became part of his act. He talked about the stupid woman from the Sunday Times with the fat ass for the
Jesus.
Rest of the shows, which was quite rude. So yeah, there were definitely, we had some memorable encounters.
What was Gorbachev like?
Gorbachev was the most charismatic person I've ever met. It was extraordinary. I did the interview in a very tiny room in the Ritz or somewhere like that. And I was sitting, I had to kind of sit at his feet because he had was surrounded by so many advisors. And even through a translator, he just emanated charisma. He was incredible. I was really impressed by him. He just had this amazing warmth, enthusiasm. I've since met Bill Clinton, who has it too, but Gorbachev really had it.
I've met Bill Clinton, but only very briefly. We were introduced to him at the Labour Party conference about 10 years ago. And I was introduced to him with like 10 other people, and they all said something. We were all named. Mm. But then about 10 minutes later, he then said, oh, how are you doing, Paul? And he'd remembered my name from 10 minutes earlier.
Yeah.
And I was just utterly starstruck at that point.
No, he was amazing. He has that real capacity. He talks about when you go somewhere, how you have to really see people. That he talks about an African phrase of when you meet someone, you don't say hello, how are you? You say, I see you.
Mm.
And he really means that. And he really means it about the kind of the lady who's making the tea or the man who's opened the car door. He kind of sees everyone and wants to engage with them. He's a really incredible person, I think.
I mean, some of the people that I know that are in the public eye, they don't present a false persona to the public, but they clearly are different behind the scenes than they are in real life. Do you always feel an obligation to kind of articulate that difference? Some of the people that I've worked with that are quite warm and friendly on television are much less so in real life. And the opposite, actually. Some of the people that I know that have a kind of curmudgeon-like persona in the public are actually incredibly warm and friendly.
Yeah, I think that's very true. What you're trying to do as an interviewer, I think your key role is to sit there and say, what is it like to spend an hour sitting opposite this person? You know, what are their tics? Do they look you straight in the eye? Are they a laugh? You know, are they kind of warm and friendly? Are they really hard work? You know, would you want to go out for a beer with them? You know, maybe not. I think it's really important to really get that visceral sense of what it's like to sit in the room. So everyone can read a profile or kind of see what they think. It's like, what are they actually like? You know, what skin to skin, human to human, what kind of a buzz do you get off them?
Because in a sense, it's easy for me. I can ask a couple of dumb questions and our listeners can actually tell what you're like by you saying what you're like and getting a feeling for it. It must be difficult to kind of capture that in words. I couldn't do that.
Well, it's often the small things that give them away, or the way that they greet you. Often in an interview, the things that you end up kind of picking up or picking out, maybe tiny moments actually in the exchange. It's kind of, you know, how do they shake hands? Do they look at you? Do they ask anything about you? Some people, a lot of celebrities that you interview have been asked the same questions so many times.
That must kill them.
You know, and then they trot out an answer and you think, oh, I've already read that in 10 different cuts. So it's often the challenge getting them to talk about something else. A really brilliant feature writer that I worked with when I was younger, Robert Chalmers, once said to me, if you ask them questions, you'll get answers to the questions. He was a great believer in the power of silence, or a slightly kind of awkward thing where you kind of let your interviewee just do a bit of a kind of chain of, you know, train of thought and a bit of an abstraction. And then you might get something that you had absolutely no idea about. And I always thought that was quite a good one, that sometimes if you leave a silence, people will often try and fill that silence. And then you might get something that you really weren't expecting. And
that's I'm getting lessons sometimes. In doing this podcast.
Yeah. But the power of silence, I'm a great chatterbox, and people always think it's hilarious that I talk about the power of silence, but it is really good technique in an interview.
I'm a chatterbox as well, and I do deliberately make an effort to shut up because people are listening to this to hear from you. I got a piece of advice very early doing this podcast where someone said, you're doing a great job, Paul, but just shut up more and let them speak.
Yeah, yeah.
So I deliberately do that. But yeah, when I speak to guests afterwards, if I don't know them, they say, oh, you're more chatty than you were
people.
In a podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and how does that work then in terms of your preparation for an interview? Do you come up with a list of questions in your head and then go in kind of naked without them written down? Or do you have a kind of backup sheet of paper? How does it work? You're there with Theresa May. Do you kind of just walk in and see where the conversation takes you?
No. I would structure the questions very carefully, and I think most interviewers would too. So you've got a good sense of how you want the conversation to go. I'm sure you do that a bit in your podcast. You see you looking down at your phone occasionally. So you have a sense of the form that the conversation might take. When I went to see Theresa May, our political editor, Tim Shipman, said to me, take lots of questions.
He's good as well as Tim, actually.
He interviewed her before. And you're never quite sure. Theresa's very thorough, but you can ask her questions and you just get a one-word answer. You know, how was your childhood? Happy.
Tell us more.
Yeah, tell us more.
What type of happy?
But even so, I think it's always better to have too many questions. The absolute worst thing in an interview is sitting there, kind of slightly looking at the clock, looking at your notebook, thinking, I've run out of questions. How am I going to fill the next 10 minutes?
But sometimes you can almost be bound by the questions themselves. Because, like you say, I have three or four topics on my phone.
Yeah.
It's mainly as an Ed memoir, really.
Yeah.
I don't want to forget stuff. We had Mark Thompson in recently, and I forgot to ask him about Savile. You know,
yeah.
And everyone was on Twitter, why didn't you ask him about Savile? Did he force you to sign an NDA?
No.
Did you agree?
I
just forgot.
Yeah.
You know, I got sidetracked about talking about iPlayer.
Yeah, so you have a kind of list of things that you know you've got to cover. So, you know, Brexit,
yeah.
Sexual abuse, stuff about the family, stuff about the marriage, which is more of a kind of, you better not forget those or you're really going to be in trouble.
Yeah.
Yeah, a kind of framework. But also, I think if you're going to interview the Prime Minister, and particularly someone who's as thorough as she is, it's a bit like being in front of a rather kind of slightly fierce headmistress. You don't want to mess up. I was quite keen to kind of show her that I'd really done my homework.
And was she impressed by that?
Well, I think she would have been unimpressed if I hadn't, let's put it that way.
So what's next for you then, in terms of, you know, is there a bigger name than the Prime Minister that you want to interview?
Oh, I don't know about it.
Do you want to get Trump?
Trump would be amazing, although Michael Gove did that last week. I
think you'd ask him different questions than Gove did.
I might have asked him, been a bit tougher on him on the ladies. I think that would be fair to say. I love editing the Sunday Times magazine. It's an absolutely fantastic train set for any editor to have. We have some of the best writers, amazing photography. It's really fun. Most people will talk to us. It's a really incredible opportunity, and I'm really loving it.
What's a typical week for you then? I imagine you have Mondays off and you start again on Tuesdays. What is a typical week?
On the magazine, we work I work Monday to Friday. So the Sunday Times office on a Monday is a very strange place because only some of the features people are there. All the news and sport and business people don't come until Tuesday.
It's their Sunday, isn't it?
Yeah, it's their Sunday. So I have done that. When I was the Focus editor on news, I used to work Tuesday to Saturday. But we work Monday to Friday. And we have lots of deadlines. Magazines are strange. You're always working 2 weeks ahead. So in my head, I'm already on like the 5th of February, even though we're still in mid-January. So you're on slightly strange time. So Monday is very much a magazine day. Tuesday, the editor and everyone are in, and I go to the main conference, and we're talking about stuff for that week. And it gets pretty busy. As editorial director, I also liaise a lot with our brilliant people in marketing and with commercial, and I'm looking at the paper more in the round and what we can do as kind of promotions, what might sell it, how we can bring all those things to bear together to get the best product. So I'm in and out of a lot of meetings. Some days I feel a bit like a ping pong ball.
Yeah, like a meeting person. I do that. I have sometimes like 10 meetings one day and then drive home thinking, all I've done is just have meetings.
So you feel absolutely exhausted. And of course, I'm trying to edit the magazine. So I'm doing all these meetings and then running back to my desk and looking at layouts and changing headlines and trying to recopy. I do a lot of reading stuff kind of quite late at night. My children aren't very keen on that. They're like, Mum, get off your phone.
Do you have a typical reader in mind when you're kind of writing for the Sunday Times or in meetings thinking about a typical reader? Because, I mean, I read the Sunday Times vociferously. I have not read a paper-based version of it for years. It's always on the iPad.
Yeah.
And I like the fact, frankly, that it breaks stories. There seems to me to be fewer interesting stories in some of the other papers. You guys have a commitment to actually getting scoops.
Well, the point about the Sunday Times is we don't just want to sum up the news that has been there in the last week. We want to set the agenda for the week ahead, as I think we did yesterday. We had a brilliant story about Trident and the test going wrong. And there's always been a very strong kind of high bar in the Sunday Times newsroom that there has to be some proper stories in the paper that people are going to read about. I mean, the aim on the Sunday Times is to be leading the news agenda for the whole of Sunday and into Monday morning, and to create the story which then people are going to speak about in the week.
And then the Prime Minister was on the Mar show, refused to answer the question memorably four times.
Yes, about your story,
and that boosts your story.
Yeah, and I think that in a world where we're getting absolutely overloaded with information all the time, and there's tweets and blogs and all those kind of things, actually, newspapers are still really important because they are the places which actually pay investigative journalists to dig up new stuff. And the point about being a Sunday paper is you're not following other people's press releases. You actually have time and the staff to really go around and do some proper digging, whether that's our enormous FIFA investigation into corruption or drug doping that we did, and Lance Armstrong, or Cash for Questions within Parliament. The Sunday Times has a really proud tradition going back to thalidomide to really try and uncover big scandals and big stories.
We've got Harry Evans coming on the podcast in a few weeks, actually.
Yeah, I'm sure he'll tell you all about that. But I think that the Sunday Times is actually one of the last papers that really has a commitment to that kind of investigative journalism, which takes a very long time, is really expensive, particularly these days with the kind of legal threats that get thrown at you. And we never forget that news is something that someone somewhere doesn't want you to get out there. And it's getting harder and harder to get through the phalanxes of legal letters and actually get stories out there into the public domain. I think the public have absolutely no idea how hard it is, particularly to break those big stories, how brave you have to be as an editor, or how brilliantly skilled our lawyers are so that you can get round it. And the incredibly painstaking facts and the way that the reporters really go about things, and all big things for the Sunday Times. For instance, one of the stories I'm very proud of running on the Sunday Times magazine was I sent Christina Lamb, Christina Lamb, OBE, our foreign correspondent.
She's been on this podcast and was a fantastic guest.
Brilliant, brilliant woman, brave woman. She went to Nigeria for me to try and find out what had happened to the girls that Boko Haram took into the forest. And everyone had forgotten about them. So at the time, there was all that Michelle Obama, bring back our girls, all those celebs at Cannes. We fit in these girls. We see our own children. 2 years later, people had done absolutely nothing about it. And Christina Lamb uncovered that they had known where the children were. They could have got them back, and they didn't. And I think that there's an absolutely appalling kind of disjunct between how we value human life. So you look at Madeleine McCann, one small blonde girl who disappears in Spain, I mean, Portugal. Awful for her family. I'm
absolutely
not denying that. But this was 500 girls, and they were part of a much larger thousands of girls who'd been kidnapped by Boko Haram, raped in the forest, forced to marry thugs. And nobody cared about it. We could have got them out, nobody minded. And I think that is racism.
Is it just because they're black? But it's not just merely that they're black, in a sense. It's that they're also over there. They're thousands of miles away, further away than Madeleine McCann disappeared in, and therefore it's even less relevant.
But I think what's really hypocritical is when the whole world goes, bring back our girls, and then we see ourselves, and then they do absolutely nothing about it. So one of the things you can do as a magazine editor, and it's great about being on the Sunday Times because you have the resources, is that you can go, actually, I'm not going to allow this issue to moulder and to forget about these girls. I'm going to send Christina Lam out there. And it was very expensive. It was really dangerous. She was in a really kind of an area where they go, the Foreign Office are going, do not go.
She is awesome, though.
And she is completely awesome. You know, bow down, you know, big praise to Christina Lam. And she came back with a really fantastic story with photographs. So what's amazing about the Sunday Times and the magazine is that we can still do that. And we're one of the very few places left where we really can bring those stories to life.
Do you feel a sense of kind of personal and corporate jeopardy, though, for her as a human being, that you've commissioned her and you've sent her into that dangerous land? She could have been killed or worse.
Oh, it's absolutely appalling. I slept incredibly badly the week that she was in Nigeria. She has to call in twice a day to tell us that she's all right. And literally, if she misses that call by a minute or so, there's a whole action plan that swings into action to get her out. Let's not forget another very brave female correspondent on the Sunday Times, Marie Colvin, died in Homs 4 years ago. She would have been 61 last week. There was a lovely lunch for her. There's some people called the Marie Colvin Circle, a very brave group of female journalists in the Middle East. Lise Doucette from the BBC and Lindsay Hilson from Channel 4, who've set up a group of people to support journalists in the Middle East. So if you run a story in Iraq and the government don't like it, the Marie Colvin Circle will help you. You know, if you suddenly get taken hostage by the state, they'll kind of be banging on the right doors to get you out. They're a really incredible group of women. I think Marie would be really proud.
And rightly so. I mean, journalists seem to me to be in yet even more danger these days in the Middle East than they were before. If you look at ISIS, they're constantly trying to...
Well, they're now targets.
Yes, exactly.
In a way that, I mean, it used to be that if you had a massive, great bulletproof vest
that said press on you,
then
you wouldn't be shot at or kidnapped or put in a jumpsuit and paraded on social media.
A bit like being part of the Red Cross. You know, you were seen as above the conflict. Now, of course, I mean, Marie Colvin was targeted by Assad's government because they knew she was there. She'd just done a report on the BBC about a dead baby who'd been found in the rubble. And they knew exactly where her coordinates were, and she was killed. They didn't want Marie to get that story out. So I think it is terrifying how journalists have become targets themselves because it makes a newsworthy thing and because people like tyrants like Assad do not want the world to know the truth. And that is the point about journalism that we forget. I mean, all this stuff this week, Trump talking about people talking about alternative facts. Incredible. There aren't alternative facts. Things are either right or wrong. I was joking with my subs this morning. I was going, you know, oh, so if we make a mistake, can we just call it an alternative fact in future? Yeah, I don't think so. But that really, I think, completely degrades the purpose of the journalistic profession, which is to tell the truth. And it degrades the memories of colleagues of mine who've died trying to do that because they really believe in it and they think it really matters. And it offends me when I hear Trump talking about journalists as the scum of the earth, etc. They're not. Maybe they're just trying to hold him to account. In a democracy, journalists are the fourth estate. It matters. You hold power to account. Nobody else does it.
But do you think that the media still haven't quite got a handle on how to handle Trump, because he doesn't seem to be troubled by the truth?
That's very convenient. Maybe that's useful in business. that may be the facts, but I'm just going to ignore them and go off over here. But I think if you're the president, you do have to deal in a fact-based world, and you can't send your press spokesman out just attack people and say, this isn't true.
That was disgraceful.
It was. I mean, the pictures of the Mal. I mean, when we were watching, I was watching the inauguration ceremony on Friday, and we were thinking, oh, it looks quite empty against Obama. And you could Google the pictures of Obama's inauguration. It's not a lie to say that there were more people there for Obama than there were for Trump. I think there were more people. The transport people in Washington reported there were more people on the Women's March.
Three times more than there had been
for the inauguration.
Do you not think that Sean Spicer, Trump's spokesman, loses credibility himself? Because I think, well, if they're going to lie as something as trivial and as vanity-driven as that, then how can we trust them on ISIS, Boko Haram, trade deals, whatever it's going to be?
I think it's absolutely terrifying. I mean, I think it means that real journalism, the kind of journalism that I think my paper stands for becomes more important than ever, because I think that the places where people do trust the information are becoming few and far between. And actually, people talk about, you know, is it the end of print media, all those kind of things. The problem with the declining advertising model that newspapers have, which means that for many of them, they have a lot less money to pay journalists and do investigations, is I think that we're beginning to see the annihilation of a whole profession of journalists. Mm. That there are all sorts of incredibly skilled people who I've, you know, journalists I've known over the years who really know how to go through balance sheets or complicated political reports or things which have been given to select committees, or all of that stuff's really skilled, or court reports. And there's a whole professional way of looking at that stuff and a skill set which is just not going to be replicated. It's partly because there aren't people like that anymore on local newspapers, or not enough of them, and there isn't a kind of professional path through it that young journalists coming in are paid a pittance. Often now, that there is, doesn't seem to be a career path through it. And I think that matters, not just because I love newspapers and I have kind of ink in my veins, which I do, but because that really matters for our democracy. That if there aren't really clever, thorough, dogged people going through court documents, what people say, checking the facts, then you do allow a Trump-like world to flourish.
And how can we deal with that as a media? So, for example, Meryl Streep, she accepts the Golden Globe, and she quite rightly says that she was disgusted that the president-elect, as he then was, mocked a disabled reporter.
Yeah.
He then denies that he did. It then cuts to the clip of him clearly mocking the disability of that reporter. And then he tweets that she's overrated, as if that's... I mean, talk about an ad hominem.
Well, it's called playing the man, not the bull, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
So she's made a correct statement, which he was... obviously derogatory about the disabled reporter. We've all seen the clip. And then he says that black is not what, you know, white is black, black is white.
But then the news anchor then says, and in other news, there doesn't seem to be a sufficient kind of dwell time on the fact that he's a blatant liar.
But I think that people are beginning to pick up. I mean, it's actually one of the good things about social media, I think, is that when someone does that, there was an instant furore on Twitter and stuff saying, how can he talk about alternative facts? I mean, I think that people do know. What's really scary is the kind of fake news universe, which immediately kind of bombards people who don't really know any better with saying, oh, you know, Trump's not making it up, the media are lying. That's why I think it's very dangerous when he starts saying, well, the media are liars, because then where is the truth in all of this? And of course, we have to remember it's very easy, or it's useful for powerful people not to have people checking the facts. You know, if you're Donald Trump, it's much easier to be able to say, oh, well, they're all making it up and I didn't actually do that, than it is to admit that he did. I mean, what's incredible about him, I think, is the brazenness with which he just continues. He's not playing by the rules as they have traditionally been set up. But that doesn't mean to say that he will get away with it forever.
How does the media raise its game then to meet head on the challenge of someone like this? I mean, I subscribe...
I think you have to keep pointing out what he's doing.
I mean, he was attacking the New York Times so much that I actually subscribed to it because I thought, well, if he's going to have a go at them, then they must be doing a good job and I want to see them succeed.
Well, CNN, you know, that's a serious news broadcaster, the New York Times. Okay, some of these have got more of a liberal bias, so he's not going to like them. And if you think about British politicians, there are quite a lot of Labour politicians who, you know, who hate the Sun or hate the tabloids or talk about the right-wing press. I mean, you do get it from both sides, but I do think that this is of a different order.
But how does the media deal with this in terms... I mean, you touched on it earlier in terms of newsrooms have fewer people in it these days. You know, newspapers do have to wash their face financially. You're very lucky.
Yeah, we're very lucky.
We have a generous
proprietor who believes in newspapers.
Yeah, and the fruits of Murdoch's investment in the Sunday Times is evident because you get quality journalism and quality journalists. But on the other hand, I don't say that to flatter because I genuinely believe it. But on the other hand, you know, the Independent's gone out of print and has terrible kind of numbers now. Digitally, you know, you've got a lot of bloggers. There seems to be so much less money in journalism generally. People are looking to other careers now.
That's what I think is really terrifying, because it's all very well saying, oh, well, there isn't any money in journalism, people have to go into other careers, but then who holds the powerful to account? That is what the press does. We're going to have to find new ways of funding journalism. That I mean, that's quite an unpopular thing, is that journalists are often as unpopular as estate agents or lawyers.
Yeah.
But I do think that maybe all this stuff around fake news and alternative facts will actually remind people how important it is to have unshowy, unflashy, slightly grey investigative journalists sitting there trudging through the detail, and that the facts actually matter, that the facts are sacred. And in a way, all the social media, all the kind of fuss, it's all opinion, it's comment, isn't it? It's not actually saying, well, what's going on here? Who, what, when, why? You know, that's what really matters. That's what, as a journalist, it's really important to get those facts right.
Sunlight is the best disinfectant.
Yes, absolutely, sunlight's the best disinfectant. And it's the only way to hold the powerful to account. So I do think it really matters, and we're kind of laughing about it, but it's actually incredibly serious.
I mean, I was a local councillor in my former hometown of York many, many moons ago. And if there was a journalist in the chamber, we would raise our game, all of our politicians. You could just tell if the local paper had sent someone. Now, they probably sent someone one in five or six meetings. And the ones where there wasn't a journalist there, we were incredibly cavalier. We barely followed the agenda. It does
make people behave better.
It does.
The risk that what you say might end up on a front page. And I think what's also interesting is that even though there's now a massive kind of news ecosystem, it is often the newspapers that break the stories. The Sunday Times, Trident, all the other media are talking about it. But which talk radio show or which blog is actually breaking the story in the first place? Who's got the resources to do that? And that is the massive question. I think it's why it's important people go on paying for news. At News UK, we've been criticised on the Times and the Sunday Times for, say, having a paywall. But we're now getting proper money from our digital subscribers, which allows us to do the kind of journalism which then everybody else talks about. And the ones who haven't gone down that route are really in trouble, because as the advertising collapses, the display advertising is down 20% every year. That's why people like The Guardian are really in trouble, because they've got no other source of revenue.
Well, they've sold Auto Trader, haven't they?
So they've got a kind of pot of cash in the bank, but once that's gone, The Guardian's gone. And if you believe that in news worth paying for, as we talk it, or that journalism is a valuable thing, then as a punter, you've got to be prepared to put your money where your mouth is.
I read The Times probably once or twice a week. Then when it was online, then it went behind a paywall. And I wrote a piece actually saying this is incredibly short-sighted, blah, blah, blah. And then after about a month, I wasn't reading The Times at all because it was behind a paywall. And I thought, well, I'll subscribe. I think there was a special offer or something. Yeah. And I got that. And then when I started paying for it, I now read it every day. Yeah. And in fact, on my commute into London every day, I read The Times on my iPad.
It's brilliant on the iPad. It's really good.
But I read it more now. I do pay the monthly amount.
Well, because you pay, because also there's a value to the things that you pay for. You also see that you're handing over your money. It's something that you want. It's something that you need. You're allowing a proper service to take place. And The Guardian are now busy. Every time you log into The Guardian, it's saying, please give us some money. Please give us some money. And they, having criticised us for years on that, and now realising that if you give it away, it becomes valueless. People won't pay for it. And also, then why would you pay for the expensive print product if you're giving it all away online?
And their ask is a bit like, become a friend of The Guardian. It's incredibly vague, because they're not saying...
It's kind of passive-aggressive, but vague.
But, you know, you guys, if you don't pay the paywall, I don't get access to the articles. No. With The Guardian, I still get everything for free, and I'm somehow guilt-tripped into giving them 10 quid a month.
You can get some access. We've got this new thing called registered access, so you can get one... I think you can get one article if you put your email in. So that's brilliant on social media. So if you're not a subscriber but you want to read one thing, we give you one as a little temptation. And actually, that's brilliant at converting people into subscribers.
So, I mean, this is a deliberately kind of vague and almost insipid question, but how optimistic are you for the future of journalism?
Ooh, big question. I'm optimistic because I think that I hope that people will realise that actually they need us, that they want to know proper, intelligent people want to know proper facts about things that are going on. And actually, a society without a free and rigorous press is really a dictatorship.
When you've been inspired by several topics like FGM and, internet porn. You made them big campaigning issues. Mm. What was the genesis behind those? How did they catch you, and how did you take your role as a campaigning journalist?
Well, I think often campaigning comes out of things which are personal. I was the governor of a school in a city bit of London where my own girls went, which had a very large Somali refugee population. And I read a lot about female genital mutilation, and particularly about how pervasive it was within that community. And I became really worried that some of the little girls who'd been educated with my own little girls all the way through might have that happen to them. And I became very determined to try and raise awareness about that and to try and stop it happening. And one of the things I feel really proud of is I persuaded my editor, John Witherow, to really go big on that. When we first started writing about FGM in the Sunday Times, it was this kind of thing that occasionally came up on the Guardian women's page. No one really talked about it. We put it on the front page of the paper. We wrote a big leader about it. We did a double page spread inside. I went up to Birmingham and talked to some midwives. We did a big investigation and some people who were doing it. It was a really big deal. And actually, as a result, I think partly as a result of that, David Cameron and his team really picked up on it. And now people know about it and they talk about it, and it's part of a safeguarding project, and doctors look for it. And if you're a social worker in a school, you have to ask about it. It's become much more on people's radar, and that's the way that you make change. And the other thing, around online porn, I became very concerned. Again, it came from out of a kind of school gate conversation that I was talking to another mum who'd been doing some homework with her daughter, and they clicked on a picture of the moon and it had gone straight through to a whole load of, moaning, groaning group sex. And her 8-year-old had seen this thing and couldn't get it out of her head, kept talking about it, asking her mum about it, just had no frame of reference to understand what she'd seen at all.
You can't blame her, poor lass.
And my friend was completely traumatised. The poor little girl was totally traumatised. And I thought, well, how is it that in a society which has an 18 limit for movies, where we have a 9 p.m. watershed, where you're not allowed to swear on the radio — I got told off by Lorraine on ITV once for saying it was pissing with rain, you know.
Oh, well, iTunes will let you say that, but it's the stronger words.
The stronger ones might have to go. So how can that be the case? And it just seemed to me to be really wrong and to be against the kind of our society's kind of values. So I really started looking into it. Then I was interested in the effect of, and I still am, what happens. Then the average age now that children look at porn is about 9 or 10. If you are a young male child whose first kind of real sense of sex or their own sexuality is seeing very hardcore, degrading images of women, what does that do to your sexual dial? I mean, it sets it to extreme before you've even had a chance to kind of get a bit of a look up a lady's skirt or something. I mean, it's really, and I'm really not coming at this from a Mary Whitehouse kind of point of view, but I was kind of quite shocked at what I saw was happening to sexuality. I mean, I grew up in a very liberal household. I mean, I really don't have a kind of sex is bad ethos at all, but I did think that the kind of sexual stimuli which young people were getting when they had nothing to put against it was really wrong. And I started going into schools and talking about it. One young kid said to me, "Oh, are you saying that learning about sex from porn is a bit like learning to drive from the Fast and the Furious?" Which I thought was a good line.
Actually, they have a point.
Yeah, they have a really good point.
Because you do have to learn to drive and memorise the highway code first.
Exactly.
It is a bit
or
dull.
Kind of at least know that maybe it's about love, or it can be about affection or caring about someone, that it's not a rather kind of animalistic thing or a joke. So I just really began to really worry about it. I still feel really passionately about it. But I think the more people are coming around to my way of seeing it. And again, that really got people's attention. David Cameron started talking about parental controls on computers. There's now a big move for proper sex education in schools, partly as a result of the kind of generation XXX who've been bred on this stuff, and which is fueling a huge rise in sexual aggression towards girls at school. I'm the mother of a 14-year-old girl and an 11-year-old girl. I believe me, I really care about that.
And rightly so. How does it work in terms of, you're clearly passionate about these issues and you're a journalist. Does anyone ever criticise you because they say, oh, you've become a campaigner on this issue rather than writing about it journalistically?
Well, I was a columnist for 3 or 4 years on the Sunday Times, maybe longer actually. And so as a columnist, you are kind of allowed to ride your hobby horses. That's kind of where you're allowed to kind of do some opinion.
You read columnists for, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And I was a great believer that I wanted to be the kind of columnist who kind of broke some stories and found some things out. And you can be a kind of Giles Corran style columnist, make it all up out of your head, or you can kind of actually go and... I thought I was incredibly lucky to be given a space in the paper to pontificate every week. And so if I had that, I was going to try and do it about things that I thought really mattered. So I would really go off and do some research and talk to people and do it. And sometimes I do bigger pieces, and I've done some TV and that kind of thing around it too. And I think I feel good about that, really do. There are things that I feel proud of. I feel like I shifted the dial. And the great thing about the Sunday Times is if you put something on the front page of the Sunday Times, you get it into the brains of the people who are the most influential people in this country. We have about 2.5 million readers. We have over 1 million people who buy the paper in various forms every week. And they're not just they're not just kind of people who are individuals who are influential. They're people who we say they're not just the people who might buy one car. They're the kind of people who will buy 1,000 cars for their whole fleet. And so if you really start getting into those people's heads that something needs to change or something matters, there's then a very quick response. And what I loved about editing the news review for years was phrases that you put in there, you would then hear on the Today programme, people would speak, you would what you had put out there would become part of the national conversation. And I feel incredibly privileged and honoured to have been given, you know, the chance to do that.
Eleanor, it's been an absolute pleasure. If people want to join or find out more about Women in Journalism, what's the website address?
We're www.womeninjournalism.com. We're on Twitter at WIJ, W-I-J, underscore UK.
And is it right that men can come along to the events too and support the organisation generally?
Yeah, absolutely. We have quite a lot of men at our parties and men can come along, and we're an equal opportunity organisation. We believe that when women flourish, men flourish.
Well, you may well see me at one of the future events. Thank you ever so much for your time.
You're very welcome.
A Big Things Media production.
Big Things!